Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee will come to order. Welcome, everyone. May the record show it's December 3rd. Time is 9:10. We're meeting in room 112 of the state capitol. I'm Chuck Wigger. I co-chair this with Representative Mariani, who's just arriving. And we apologize that there are hopefully still several to be here, but we do want to start as close to on time as we can. We are delighted that we have new members to the group. There was a lot of discussion at the legislature about the importance of doing that, and we're going to have a staff presentation on some of the reasons for that change, as well as a lot of information on the background. Some of you have heard it before, but others haven't, and we'll talk about that. And there is a point, too, for election of committee chair. And that's wide open if anyone would aspire for that. Traditionally, it's been rotated between the House and the Senate, or co-chaired whatever works. And finally, we'll look at the discussion for future meetings. Legislatively, in the statute, I believe we need to meet twice a year. That won't happen for this year, obviously, but barring something unforeseen. But 2009, we'll look at that, and you'll see we're hoping to go up north to have a tour in June of 2009. So that's the overview for the meeting. And at this point, we'd like to do introductions, and perhaps we could just start, go around the table, and maybe in 1 minute or less, indicate who you are and a little bit about your background, and include where you were born, where you're born, and why you're on this group. Or wanted to be.
Okay, I guess I'll start. My name is Bob Krebs, and I'm currently the land commissioner in St. Louis County. To respond to the question, I was born in Muskegon, Michigan, graduated from Michigan State University, and currently I just finished 42 years in the forestry forest management business. So I think I bring a little knowledge to the table.
Thank you.
My name is John Herman. I was born in Akron, Ohio, and came to Minnesota in 1971. Early in my law practice, I did a great deal of work in environmental law, and now I'm a partner at Fagery & Benson. I do primarily zoning, land use, real estate development, real estate finance, and similar kinds of projects. Particularly urban redevelopment projects.
Thank you.
My name is Mark Johnson. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association out of Grand Rapids. I was born in Crookston, Minnesota, and raised in Fertile up in the Red River Valley. Graduate of Bemidji State University and St. Scholastica. And unlike Bob, I bring little information to the table, maybe.
I'm Ron Nargang. I was born about 70 miles south of Rochester, a little town in New Hampton, Iowa, and spent 23 years with the Department of Natural Resources, 7 with the Nature Conservancy, and I am primarily retired. Now I do a little part-time work with the Minnesota Environmental Initiative.
Good morning. I'm Joe Silko, superintendent in Grand Rapids. I was born in a small town in Wisconsin, Lone Rock, Wisconsin. I have a large interest in government workings. It was generated early when my mother was the private secretary of the governor of the state of Wisconsin, Tony Earle. And so I got into that field, spent a lot of time in the state capitol there. I spent most of my 30-plus years in education in the community of Grand Rapids, and where forests in particular are very important.
I'm Representative Lauren Solberg. I'm on the committee, I guess, because I chair the Ways and Means Committee in the House of Representatives. I was born in Black Duck, Minnesota, actually out on the farm at home in Black Duck, Minnesota. But I'm the third person on the side of the table from the Grand Rapids constituency now, so we're going to control this no matter what. I graduated from Bemidji State and Harvard University, and I've been on this about before, so appreciate it.
Morning. My name is Carlos Mariani, the state rep for this area. The Capitol actually sits in the northern part of my district. I represent downtown St. Paul on the west side, and I was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
You're so, welcome.
Thank you. Abby, it's an honor to remember you to your caucus. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you today. It feels good to have this table, Senator Wigger, be bigger, actually. And I think it's really going to add a lot to the dimensions of our discussions. And, you know, I've only served on the Trust Fund Committee for a year with you as well. So I'm on a steep learning curve, but I picked up pretty quickly that I think the big changes from many of our previous discussions to our future discussions have a lot to do with our growing sensitivity and awareness of the responsibility not only to be good stewards of the environment, which Minnesota has always done, but to be good stewards of the environment in a pretty rapidly changing world that has all sorts of demands, which offers some great opportunities for perhaps alternative energy development discussions that could be at this table involving our lands. And so I'm really looking forward to our ongoing interaction in the coming months.
Thank you. And Chuck Wigger, I was born a few blocks from here at Anchor Hospital, it was called then, and a lifelong resident of the area, now in Maplewood, and represent Maplewood, North St. Paul, Oakdale area in the State Senate, chair of the Education Committee. My godfather was Charlie Aspley, who lived on Black Duck Lake, and caught many fish there, and don't know about the Black Duck connection, but it's there, so... we had a lot of great memories throughout the state over the years, and it's an honor to be a part of this process, something that the legislature talked a great deal of for this fund. We knew it was there, but we also recognized the importance of it, especially during the tight financial times in terms of the potential revenue that's there, and we'll continue to be there and grow as we see. We know there's fluctuations in the economy, but we see a lot of potential growth. And the legislature, as we'll find out more soon, spent a great deal of time discussing some additional ways to add to our membership, to review the importance of this fund, the yield that we get on it, fiduciary, the trust responsibility that we have, but then very importantly, seeing that those funds go to school districts as provided in our Constitution. And so we'll talk more. I do want to acknowledge the Minnesota School Boards Association. Grace Schwab Kelleher is here, and their organization did a great deal through the delegate assembly efforts and then here at the Capitol to see that additional changes were made. And I know others here were also involved, but I wanted to mention those efforts as well. So we'll go next to the charge, the official charge to the committee, and we'll ask one of our fiscal analysts, Eric Nauman. And at any point, members, if you have a question, just ask it, and we'll try to interact as informally as we can. Welcome, Mr. Nauman.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Again, my name is Eric Nauman. I'm the fiscal staff with the Senate. I had some role in the process of the drafting of the language that brings all of you here to the table today. The committee that on which you sit has existed for many, many years, but in the last legislative session, the legislature took a new approach, wanting to enhance the committee and giving some additional expertise. And so I thought what I would do is sort of go through some of the changes in the new legislation. I'm going to work off the packet that's titled 2008 Changes to the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee and Associated Laws, because there is a couple of things in the in last year's K-12 education portions of the finance bill that also affect this. And I'd like to make this short, and if you have questions, feel free to jump in. What I think I'll do first is, talk through the associated the changes to the committee. We'll talk about membership, some of your existing responsibilities, some of the new reporting provisions, and then some of the other requirements. So before I begin, are there questions at the outset? Good, that makes it easy. The existing membership prior to the changes in 2008 had the chairs of the two education policy committees serving, and as the chair, as Senator Wieger has already mentioned, it has been by custom that is the chairs rotated between House and Senate, but there's no reason that it has to be that, so at the committee's pleasure, you could elect a different chair. The chairs of the Senate Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee were in existing law as members, the Commission of Education, and then two school district superintendents. What is new as a result of the 2008 legislation is that the two chairs of the Education Budget Divisions, that would be Senator Stumpf and Representative Greiling, were added. The chairs of the Environment and Natural Resources Committee and the chairs of the Environment and Natural Resources Budget Division were also added. And then the expert fields, in which many faces that are not familiar to me, were added. So we have an expert in forestry, expert in minerals and mining, an expert in real estate development, expert in finance and land management, an expert in natural resource conservation. You know who you are and why you were put here. The 2008 legislation also requires that a non-voting member be nominated by the Department of Natural Resources, and that person will provide administrative support to the committee, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Members of the committee are appointed by. Legislative chairs are appointed by virtue of their position as being chairs. The superintendents are appointed by the Commissioner of Education. One has to be a Metro member, one has to be a non-Metro member. Expert members are appointed by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. And because the legislature is taking a vested interest in your position, language was added to the final package that gave the legislature the opportunity to provide recommendations to the Commission of Natural Resources before the appointments were made. So maybe your appointments were made through that process as well. The non-voting member, as I mentioned, was appointed by the Commission of Natural Resources. Existing responsibilities of the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee, or PISFAC, I guess would be the short way of saying it, advised the Department of Natural Resources on management of permanent school trust fund lands and recommended changes to statute, policy, and implementation to ensure provident utilization of the school fund lands. I put provident in quotations because it is what the law says, and I'm sure that the DNR is going to give you some history about how that word has been interpreted over time. Now, the new law included a series of changes to reporting provisions, reporting that this committee has to do, reporting that is made to this committee, all in an effort to enhance the sort of the intellectual heft that this committee provides to the legislature as well as what it receives. So I'll go through those now. The Commissioner of Finance, so soon to be known perhaps as the Minnesota Management and Budget Department, is required to report to you and the legislature on the management of the fund that shows how the commissioner maximized the long-term economic return of the fund. And that's a theme that the legislature was very interested in as the legislation proceeded last year, maximizing the long-term economic return of the fund. So you may see that come up again, and you may even have legislators contact you about that issue. The Commissioner of Natural Resources is required to report to you as a committee and the legislature on how the DNR has managed the funds, the school trust fund lands efficiently, reduced management expenditures. That's something the legislature was very concerned about, maximized the revenues deposited in the school trust fund. And in a moment, before I end my comments, I'm going to go through how the dollars flow and what we have a chart to kind of go through that. Managed the sale and exchange of the leased school trust fund land to maximize revenues deposited in the permanent school trust fund land. Manage school trust fund land to maximize, again, the long-term economic return. So you can see that the theme that the legislature is interested in here is ensuring that the DNR is using prudent land management principles, but also maximizing the return on the fund. then you must annually report recommendations for the management of the school trust fund lands to the legislature by January 15th of each year. So this committee has a new responsibility to be directly accountable to the legislature in terms of making recommendations. The recommendations could be we're happy and we don't see any changes necessary. I think the legislature is hoping that you will have some constructive criticism to offer. And as the requirement in the report is that it emphasize the management of school trust fund management, again, to secure the long-term economic return on the fund. But then there's some little guidance, and I'll leave those guidance that you may include, legislature hoping that you will speak to the management of the school trust funds, reduce the management expenditures, et cetera. There are a couple other requirements that I'll mention. The Commissioner of Natural Resources, again, must provide administrative support to this committee. Members of this committee serve without compensation. Sorry about that. And the members of the of this committee select your chair, as we talked about before. Now, there's an important change that I would suggest is important for this committee to think about that came out of the K-12 portions of the finance package last year. Beginning back in 1971, the legislature instituted what the Senate has referred to as the Permanent School Trust Fund subtraction. And what that means is revenues that are generated off the permanent school. You know, before I go to that, it might be worth, because I'm going to get very quickly into some lingo, to walk through this chart. It should be in your packet. And this is how the dollars of the permanent school trust fund money flow to schools. And what I'm going to first describe is how it worked up until the last bill and then what the legislature changed last year. So the big box at the top represents permanent school trust fund lands. And those lands, either through sales or proceeds from natural resources, generate money. That money, by the Constitution, is required to be deposited in the permanent school trust fund. It's got about $680 million in it now. And every year, and that fund is managed by the State Board of Investment. That fund generates, through interest and dividends, income that goes directly to school districts. And school districts are funded mostly from the general fund, dollars that the legislature appropriates directly. But prior to last year, or last year's legislation, any dollars that were generated in interest to school districts were subtracted from the money that the districts that the legislature appropriates off the general fund. So a dollar in from the interest equals a dollar subtracted from the appropriation, in very simple terms. The legislature felt that that didn't represent the spirit of the intent of the Constitution, and so it eliminated that subtraction, and that subtraction elimination begins in 2010. Why is that important? Well, it's important if you're a school district because they believe it'll generate more money for them. Previously, it was generating savings to the general fund. Annually, it's been growing, but it's about $20 million right now. So there's about $20 million distributed to school districts beginning in 2010 that we didn't have before. In terms of your charge, I think it means that people are going to be watching the work of this committee a little bit in more detail. So that's how the flow of money works, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nauman. Questions? Yes, Rep. Solberg.
Mr. Nauman, the Permanent School Trust Fund, couple of questions. Obviously, the market is not the best right now. So do we have a projection on what the new money will be? And related to that, do we take out the entire interest or growth of the availability funds, or do we, and as other dedicated funds are sometimes managed, I'm thinking of the LCCMR, a certain percentage of the base for the purpose?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, you know how the forecasting process works. We forecast all the funds in addition to doing just the general fund. coincident with the November forecast. So we will get a new estimation at that time of the health of the permanent school trust fund. It'll tell us how much money is there. It will make projections into the future years and will give us a sense of where we're going. The State Board of Investment manages that fund using fairly conservative investment principles. No, they're not pulling all the interest off. There is a calculation that they make, and I have to confess I'm not entirely conversant with it. On the school side, what I know is kind of how much that we end up subtracting. And as it grows, you know, yes, the economy is slowing, so there is an argument, and I think it will be very interesting to see how the fund performs in future years. That said, and I'm not the expert on minerals and mining on this committee, but I am aware, at least anecdotally, that there is some anticipation that some of the revenues coming from some new mining technologies up on the range is anticipated to generate some enhanced revenues into the fund. So you might have some countervailing pressures going on.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think about 10 years ago we made a change, if I'm recalling, from the entire growth of the fund being taken out to a percentage, and it might be interesting to know what that percentage is of the growth, so we don't take out all of the interest or all the growth in the fund at a particular year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, we can certainly get that calculation for this committee.
Representative Marion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nauman, just to be clear, then, the new in 2010 elimination of the subtraction, we're talking about the first year of the next biennial budget. Is that correct?
It would be the next school year, not the one that we're currently in. So, yes, you're right. It's the first year of the next biennium, the budget for which we are setting right now.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, I just, you know, noted in the little handout, the Commissioner of Natural Resources provide administrative support. So I was noting that we now have a requirement to have an annual report to the legislature. I don't know if that's new or not, but there's certainly new elements here to be reported. So my first thought was, okay, so who's going to sit at their desk and actually write this up and capture our But I take it that that means that there's someone at the commission, at the Natural Resources Department, and I suspect we'll hear from them in a little bit in terms of whether there's a particular staff person that's assigned or how they intend to provide the administrative support.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, I think that it's that was an issue that was discussed during the drafting of this legislation. I think it, in terms of, I can't speak on the legislator's behalf, but I think that Representative Dietrich and Senator Lynch had the intent that the Department of Natural Resources would, in the guise of their non-voting member, have that person take an active role in the preparation of that report with this committee.
Further questions? Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair,
and Senator Anderson, we're going to have you preface your question with an introduction. We all did a 1 minute or so background on who we are, and for those that don't know you, if you could say a little bit about yourself and where you were born.
And the correct answer is Grand Rapids, by the way.
No, I'm going to flunk that for sure. You're never going to guess. But there's a famous song about where I was born. That's a clue.
New Orleans.
Who said that? You are right. Shelby wins. Gary, Indiana. Very good. I was born in Gary, Indiana. I'm Ellen Anderson. Sorry to be late. I live in St. Paul and represent part of the city of St. Paul and the city of Falcon Heights, and chair of the Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division, which is my statutory position that puts me on this.
You may now ask your question, and thank you.
Is that enough?
Yes.
Great. Okay. I was just going to point out in response to Representative Solberg, and I don't know the details, but it does say in the constitutional language is attached here, and it does say in the Constitution that the principal of the permanent school fund shall be perpetual and inviolate forever, and that any losses to the fund essentially have to be offset by interest and dividends before has to be repaid back to the principal before the interest and dividends are distributed, but then it says the net interest and dividends shall be distributed to the different school districts of the state. So essentially the framework is that the principal maintains itself and is not spent. I don't know how we've changed the statute over the years, but at least that's what the Constitution says.
Thank you, Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair, I that's a good point, and it reminds me to reference the additional pieces that I included in this package, which I neglected to mention previously. Beginning on page 4 are the relevant actual law changes to Chapter 357, Sections 1, 2, and 36. 36 is the bulk of the changes to this committee. There are some additional requirements on the Department of Finance Commissioner or Management and Budget, or Minnesota Management and Budget Department, as well as the Commissioner of DNR in Section 2. Then in Chapter 363, which is the finance bill from last year, paragraph B of the repealer is the elimination of the subtraction that I referenced. And then finally, the very last page, as Senator Anderson has already pointed out, is the language from the Constitution that governs the Permanent School Trust Fund.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Nauman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excellent materials, and we'll make those available to those that weren't able to be with us today. Next, sort of a 101 crash course on the background of the trust land management. And while we have had legislative discussion, it's helpful to be reminded again of where things are at and get us all on the same wavelength as we proceed on future plans. So I believe we have two reps from the department, Marty Kadis and Kathy Lewis, will do that presentation. Welcome back to the committee. And if members have any questions during the presentation, just ask the question.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Marty Vadas, and I'm the Lands and Minerals Director for the Department of Natural Resources. And there is a handout that is a copy of the slides, and I might want to grab that as we go through this. And also with me today is Kathy Lewis. And Kathy, you want to introduce yourself?
Good morning. I'm Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director with Lands and Minerals, DNR.
And where were you born, Kathy?
I was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay. Marty, you can indicate that, too.
Northeast Minneapolis.
Okay.
Chairman Wieger asked us to go through this sort of a high-level overview of the school trust lands, and what we're going to cover is really what are the school trust lands and how did they come into state ownership. Look at the land management units that DNR has assigned these lands to. Talk a little about what is a trust and what are the responsibilities of trust managers. And then finally look at the revenue generation from these lands and what those sources are. This map shows the current school trust land ownership in Minnesota. And this land is a result of three federal grants, and I'll describe those three federal grants that occurred over time. The proceeds from these three land grants has been combined in the state constitution since 1974 to go into the permanent school fund. And the three types of grants were the original school trust grant, and I'll describe that. Something called the Swamplands Grant and Internal Improvement Lands Grant. And those are the three original grants that make up the today's school trust fund ownership. The first to talk about is... blocked up. And slide 3 in your... there we go.
There we go.
The first grant is school and indemnity school lands. And long-term practice in England that was followed in the U.S. was that colonial government in this country granted tracts of land to states for support of schools. And that practice was followed really through for all states, including Minnesota. And in 1857, There was an enabling act where the Congress authorized Section 13 and 36 of every township in Minnesota be granted for the purpose of funding schools. If land was already disposed of, or if it was reserved, for example, in an Indian reservation or was underwater, alternate lands could be selected, and those are called the indemnity school lands. So it's really those two grants that made up the first school trust fund land grant. About two-thirds of the land was sold. Originally, there was about 3 million acres of land that was granted, and today about 1 million acres of that land remains. And the first sale took place in 1862. The next grant that was made to the state by the Congress was called the Swamp Land Grant, and it was intended to be used for selling that land to be used to construct levees and dams. The purpose was the idea of making land productive for agriculture, and so this land was granted for that purpose, and Minnesota identified those lands by field notes and plats and government surveys. And the original grant consisted of 4.7 million acres, and about 3 million acres was given away by the state, with about 2.8 million acres going to eight railroads. So there was really no income to the school trust fund from those lands that were granted for that purpose. Also, there were grants for improvements, such as a Faribault Institute for the deaf, dumb, and blind, an insane asylum, a state prison, Stevens Cemetery, and something called the Cannon River Manufacturing Association. So those lands were used to support those activities after the lands were granted to the state. The next type of grant, the third and the last one, is called the Internal Improvement Lands, and this was a result of a recognition of a law from 1841 where other states received lands for this purpose. Minnesota asserted its rights and did receive about a half million acres for this purpose, and about 99% of these lands were sold. The total revenue from the sales was about $3 million, and most of the money went to pay off state railroad bonds that were issued to finance the early construction of railroads in the state. And so there are some internal improvement lands that remain, but only about 1% of the original grant. So that leads us to the current ownership of school trust fund lands. And this slide shows those three different kinds of grants. The acreage that was originally granted was about 8 million, and the amount that are currently owned, which is about 2.5 million. So that's the amount of school trust land that remains from the the original grants. In addition to that, there's about 1 million acres of severed minerals. And the story on that is originally minerals were sold along with the surface, but in 1889, legislation was passed to retain the mineral rights on school trust lands in Lake, Cook, and St. Louis counties. And in 1901, that was expanded to cover all counties in Minnesota. So since that time, if there's been a sale of the surface, the minerals have been retained. So there's about 1 million acres in that category. And Minnesota is really more like a western state where not all of the school trust land has been sold. Most of the eastern states sold their land long ago, and the money is long gone, and they have no residual school trust fund at all. In most western states, a great percentage of the original grant is still owned by the state and managed for schools. And so, for example, in Iowa, they have zero school trust fund lands from their original grant remaining. In Wisconsin, there's about 5,000 acres. In North Dakota, there's about 900,000 acres. And in Montana, there's about the same as we have in Minnesota, about 2.5 million acres. So there's a difference. The western states' school trust land management continues to be an issue to generate income, where in the eastern states it's a non-issue because they sold their lands long ago. So in addition to these grants that came from the federal government, there were a number of other grants that came for public purposes. And one is, you've probably heard of the University Trust Fund. The U of M was granted 72 sections of land by Congress to support the university, and there was a subsequent grant of an additional 72 sections of land. And of that, today there's something like 25,000 acres of surface that's left, and an additional 20 or 25,000 of severed mineral rights. And that land does continue to generate income for the university. There were also 10 sections of land granted for public buildings. The state capitol, for example, was partly financed through that grant. Land was sold and used to construct the state capitol. There was 94,000 acres for an agriculture and mechanical college that were granted. And I believe that's what was the St. Paul campus of the U of M, and it's now been incorporated into the U of M. So there have been a series of grants from the federal government, and they've been handled in different ways through time. The next slide shows the distribution by county of where the school trust fund land remains in Minnesota. And over 90% of that land is in 10 northern counties. Sorry, is there a question?
No,
I'm sorry.
No. The mic just pretty
please
sensitive.
Proceed.
Sorry?
No, please proceed.
We have a sensitive mic here. I'm sorry for interrupting.
The next slide then shows the management units that DNR has placed this land into. And about 80% of these trust lands are considered by DNR to be in commercial forests, which means they are capable of generating income. And the vast majority is in state forest or forestry type management. Some are in wildlife management areas, but those lands for the most part are available for revenue generation, timber harvest, for example, that sort of thing. There are some lands, for example, the scientific and natural areas that through the designation you cannot generate revenue off those lands. And the 51,000 acres that show there are all in the peatland scientific and natural areas that were designated by the legislature in 1991. There are some water access sites and a number of lands that are really outside of management units. And an example of that is there's 86,000 acres of land in the Boundary Waters Canoe area that are still school trust land and aren't in any sort of a DNR management unit. And I think we'd like to talk about that issue a bit more later on. Now, the state as a trustee, Kathy's going to kind of help walk us through some points on this.
This is basically Trust Law 101. We throw out the word trust a lot, so we thought it's important to take a moment and reflect what is a trust. There's obviously a definition in the Black's Law Dictionary. One of the issues you need to look at is who is the trustee and how do they need to deal with the property that they're responsible for. When you have a trust, you have a beneficiary. And when we look at our original land grants, not all the land grants created a beneficiary. The school lands, the original school grant, was granted to the state for the use of the schools. So a beneficiary was created. The swamp lands had no beneficiary designated when they were granted to the state. And so thus, there is no explicit trust created when that grant was issued. However, the state legislature, through the Constitution, has combined the remaining swamp lands with the original school lands, the internal improvement lands, and thus identified them all as the permanent school lands and also identified them in the statutes as school trust lands. The state as a trustee, people talk about who is the trustee. People talk about the governor being responsible, the legislature being responsible, Commissioner of Natural Resources, and the State Board of Investment. The DNR obviously has duties delegated by the legislature. The Board of Investment also has duties that are delegated by the Constitution to invest the funds. As a trustee, I want to run through just a few basic questions we should be asking. One of the questions you ask is it within my authority to perform the act that I'm being asked to perform? Do I have a duty to act? If I must act, how shall I act? If I have a choice, does the act serve the interest of the trust? This is one that the DNR often discusses as we're working on our management of the lands. We look at, will it be in the interest of this trust to do this sale? Will it be in the interest of the trust to do this land exchange? So we ask this question as we manage the lands. Some basic duties of trust manager: to use reasonable care and skill in their actions, to acquire assets of the trust, to protect the property of the trust, to invest the trust assets properly, to lease or sell the trust property as directed, to furnish information to the beneficiary, and to be loyal to the beneficiary. Legislative oversight is created, and that's the body in front of us today. And as we just heard from Mr. Newman, the legislature expanded the requirements for the DNR to report twice a year. Currently been reporting every biennium, and that's our report here. That is the last biennial report. We also have done a special report on our school trust fund revenue enhancement program in the last biennium. But so our reporting responsibilities have been increased, and also the expansion of the responsibilities of how we're reporting and what we're reporting to the legislative body. And as you know, the members have increased from 7 members to your current 19 members. Revenue is our next topic.
Revenue. Talk about revenue that's been generated and really reviewing the goal of the permanent school fund. It's very specific in law, and it's to secure the maximum long-term economic return from the lands consistent with the fiduciary responsibilities imposed by the trust relationship. And Kathy just described how we're viewing the trust relationship established in the Constitution. And then it goes on with sound natural resource conservation and management principles and with other specific policies provided in state law. So that is the direction to the DNR that that we take forward in managing these lands and what we're supposed to do to generate income and way that we're supposed to approach that with sound natural resource conservation and management principles. So this next slide is a little confusing, but I'll try to explain as best I can here. It represents really three different sources of income to the trust fund that's been generated from this land. The first one, and it's that bottom black bar, is from land sales. And what we're showing on this graph is really two things each fiscal year. One is the gross proceeds from the activity on the land, and the bar next to it represents the net proceeds to the corpus of the trust fund. So, for example, with land sales, the amount of income to the trust, the net is virtually the same as the gross. I mean, there's really virtually no deduction of land sales. So the proceeds for that go into the trust. The next one, the red bar, is from minerals. And I have a few slides later on because there's a story to tell on the mineral management cost here. But the as you can see, it's virtually the same between gross and net until you get to fiscal year 06. And there's a difference in that before fiscal year 06, the mineral management costs were covered by the general fund. And in the last biennium, there was a proposal in the governor's budget to pay for the mineral management cost from income from minerals on the land. And that was intended to be a budget balancing measure and last for one biennium. And so it was a temporary deduction of mineral management costs from mineral income. In the current biennium, the governor's budget proposed that mineral management go back to being paid for by the general fund. And in the end, legislation was passed that made the mineral management account permanent And it's set up now so that mineral management costs will be paid for out of proceeds from mineral income. And that's a permanent part of statute now. It's no longer a temporary part. And so I'll describe a little bit how that works, because there was a lot of interest last session in understanding the mineral management account. And so I'll describe that. And the third set of bars on here are the yellow bars, and that's forestry and real estate leasing. And that shows the gross receipts and then the net receipts to the corpus of the fund. And I also have some slides that describe that as well. For forest management, it has been for decades and decades that the cost of managing forests to generate the income has been deducted from the income from the land. And so that's been in place for many, many years. And so that's not new. Revenue to the corpus. There are four sources of income to the corpus. The mineral leases, less the portion deposited into the mineral management account, from land sales, from things like forest campground fees, wild rice lease fees, and standing timber from land sales. And the fourth is net revenue from the forestry suspense account. And revenue in the corpus of the trust fund is managed by the State Board of Investments, as Mr. Nauman mentioned. So DNR's role in this is to generate the income from the land. Once the income is deposited into the corpus, it's the State Board of Investment that is responsible for managing that account. The next slide shows the gross and net mineral revenue for the last few fiscal years. And I have some other slides that maybe better illustrate some of the past history. And as I mentioned, in fiscal 03, 04, and 05, the gross and the net were the same because the general fund covered the cost for mineral management. But then in 06, the income from minerals paid for that management cost. And I'll point out this is from all sources of mineral income. So that includes school trust fund, but it's also university trust fund, tax forfeit, consolidated conservation area land, LUP land, whatever the source of income is, there's a portion of it that goes towards the minerals management. And so I'll talk about that account a little bit and try to kind of walk through how that was set up in legislation. And it's set up so that, first of all, 20% of the income generated from minerals is directed into the mineral management account. The remainder is immediately distributed to whatever source, whatever the class of land is. So that means each year 80% automatically goes into those accounts. And there's 20% that's set up in the mineral management account. Then the legislature appropriates money from the mineral management account to DNR for mineral management activities. So you start out with a 20% deduction, and then there is an appropriation from the legislature from that account that funds the management activities. The mineral management account was also created to have a $3 million principal to be drawn down in the event that future income generation drops. And that amount was funded very quickly. The mineral income has been pretty extraordinary the last few years, and so that portion was funded, and it's up to the $3 million, and so there'll be no additional retention for that purpose because that's been funded. And then at the end of each fiscal year, the amount in the mineral management account that exceeds the $3 million is distributed to the school and university trust funds in the same proportion that revenue was generated. So if there is additional income, and there has been in the last few years, that money is distributed back to the different funds. At the end of fiscal 07, the permanent school fund received an additional $1.7 million from that mineral management account, And in fiscal 08, it was $2.3 million. And so then the, really the result of that is the management costs for these lands were 20% for fiscal 06. And the reason it was higher that year was that a $3 million account was funded in that first fiscal year. So the amount for management dropped to 9.3% in fiscal 07 and 8.4% last year, because the 20% is retained, but the legislature doesn't automatically let DNR use that for management. They set a limit on what it is, and right now that's about $2.8 million a year that we spend to do mineral management and generate income. And I think this next graph might help illustrate that picture a little better. This shows some stacked bars, and that is the mineral income from all state mineral lands. And then what we have broken down is the amount from the various funds. So the pink on here is the amount of income to the school trust fund. The blue is the amount that goes to the university trust fund. And the last one, which is green, is tax forfeit lands. And so, as you can see, the amount of mineral income has been increasing recently, and we're on track for the current fiscal year that will equal $35 million of income from mineral royalties and mineral rentals. Then on the bottom of this graph, you will see another set of dots. And that represents what the mineral management cost is for generating this income. And so from fiscal 05 and before, that was all general fund money. From fiscal year 06 going forward, that represents a portion of the income from the land, from mineral royalties and so forth.
Representative Solberg.
Can I interrupt,
yes.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Vadas, the income from minerals is greatly increased, obviously. Has that been a result of additional mining, or is it additional royalties? And who negotiates the royalties and sets that royalty fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, it's really, the answer is really it's both sources, from increased mining, but also the rate of royalty has gone up over time. There's really two reasons for that. One is our mineral leases have an escalator clause that reflect increases in the value of iron ore and in steel. And so part of that increase reflects the fact that those values have gone up. And to answer your other question, mineral lease negotiations, the Department of Natural Resources is responsible for negotiating those lease terms and conditions. And the Commissioner of DNR recommends to the State Executive Council issuance of leases for taconite and for other kinds of minerals as well. So the Executive Council needs to approve that recommendation of the DNR Commissioner. And as you know, the Executive Council is made up of our six constitutional officers. And for example, we have very recently renegotiated some leases with U.S. Steel. And not to give you too much detail, the rate that they were paying at the time we negotiated leases was 88 cents per ton of crude ore. And the market really was much, much better. The escalators that we had in place, we believed, and U.S. Steel eventually agreed, did not reflect current market conditions, and so we settled on a royalty rate of $1.53 per ton of crude ore. So it was a fair increase that we eventually agreed to. And so those leases were just put in place, so that increase isn't reflected in any of these numbers. That would be reflected in future income from mining.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up, if I may.
Sure.
Do you also manage, then, the university lease rate as well for the university trust fund lands? And the second follow-up, how does the state compare with private royalties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, yes, DNR is responsible for managing the minerals on really all state-owned land. So that would include university trust fund and tax forfeit as well. And we do then represent those interests. And
how does it compare? Or don't you know?
Well, there's no mechanism for us to collude with other fee owners, and we're not interested in doing that. But there's a couple of ways you can get a sense of it. One is that companies are required to report for income tax purposes their various costs, and they do report their royalty payments to fee owners. And it's a little tricky because you have to know and understand the operation, how much of it is self-owned ore that they don't pay royalty on, how much is state ore. You can get a rough sense of how much companies might be paying. They're under no obligation to tell us, but we have a good sense of it. And I would say that we're very competitive, and with this recent negotiated lease with U.S. Steel, that's probably somewhat higher than most fee owners are getting at the moment. But my belief is they may be talking to companies after, because the state royalty rate is public information, and it really is the only public information on royalty payments in the state.
Thank you.
So just point out, I know there's a part of the direction to reduce the management cost to the trust fund for the activities of DNR. And I'll just point out that for the management costs on this graph, these are real dollars. These have not been adjusted for inflation. So, for example, in the the late 80s, late 90s, we were at about around $4 million a year. And some of those years were mineral income was down in like 99 and 2000. That represented about 60% of the income for those years went into mineral management costs. And today we're at something less than $3 million of management cost, and you can see the difference in revenue generation. I guess the point I'd like to make is that we have taken very seriously through the years that direction to keep our costs at a minimum. The next slide shows non-ferrous potential, and this is not a very good map, but it's an area of northeastern Minnesota called the Duluth Complex, and I don't know if there's even any cities I can point out, but the city of Babbitt is probably about in the middle of the map here. And really what this represents is showing where there's school trust mineral rights and where there are known copper, nickel, platinum deposits in the Duluth complex. And this area represents a potential future income to the trust fund from royalties should these mining operations go into production. None of them are producing now. There are about 40,000 acres of school trust land, and my memory is, that are under lease for these kinds of deposits. And we were asked last legislative session what that might represent to the school trust fund. So we did a calculation based on the metal prices at the time, which were much higher than they are today, the amount of tons that were known. And the short version is over about a 25-year period, should those be mined, that would be about $1.4 billion of income to the school trust fund. Now, metal prices have dropped. The tonnage that was identified is about twice as much as when we did the estimate because of new drilling and new ore reserve estimates, so I can't tell you today what that value might represent, and it's not important. It's just trying to give you an idea of the order of magnitude of what this might mean to the school trust fund. And the first of these operations is in environmental review now. They're in the EIS process. Don't know what the outcome of that will be. As you know, this type of mining is much more controversial than iron mining because of the potential for acid drainage and some of those water quality issues. So this is a issue that's being worked on lot today, the potential of this sort of development or not. The next one shows trust fund land sale revenue, and I'll tell you, one of the subcommittees we're suggesting is looking at adjustments to the school trust land base. We generally do not want to sell school trust land. We think it's the best interest to the trust to retain the ownership and generate income long-term off of that. But there are some parcels in our management activities we believe will not generate revenue in the future. And so we have had a modest program to sell those lands and take the income from those sales and put it into the permanent school trust fund. And so this has just been the history over the last 10 years or so of those land sales. Forest management. Dave Epperle from the Division of Forestry is here. If you have questions on this, I think he'll be able to help. But talk a bit about, I talked about the mineral management, talk a little about the forest management. Revenue from timber sales along with fees from real estate, leases, licenses, and easements are deposited into the forest suspense account. And the costs for managing tracts, trust fund lands are certified by the Department of Finance, and that's a Minnesota statute. And the allowable kinds of costs for forest management are protection, improvement, administration, management of forest lands, and construction and maintenance of forest roads. In addition to that, the general fund is reimbursed for protection and administration costs. And the forest management investment account is reimbursed for improvements, management, and forest roads. And for fiscal 07 and 08, these revenues from forest management activities were down due to the timber industry downturn, and also costs were up due to fire management.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Solberg. I don't want to be the only one to ask questions, but it piqued my interest on the last sentence. The cost, I think, for fire suppression and firefighting in this last fire season was something like $19 million. It's a great big increase from the normal of about $7 million. Much of that was done probably as a result of the fire in the BWCA land. My question is, since there's quite a bit of school trust fund land in the BWCA, but it has no potential to ever generate income right now. Was the school trust fund then charged for any of the fire suppression in the BWCA?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, Mr. Epperle can correct me if I'm wrong, but there is a portion of the firefighting costs for fire suppression that is paid for by the school trust fund, and my belief is that that's done on a kind of a prorated basis, a percentage ownership sort of a basis, and the school trust fund did pay some of those firefighting costs. Yes,
Mr. Chair, can we get the numbers and distribute it to either my office or to members here? I think it'd be interesting to see
Mr.
them.
Chair,
particularly,
we'll see that.
I'm interested in the cost of the firefighting for the in the BWCA.
Mr. Chair, we'll have that for you.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So then this next slide tries to break down examples of the kinds of allowable costs for certification. And that includes categories like protection, which is wildfire suppression that Representative Solberg just asked about. Also administration, management, forest road activities, and improvements like reforestation and site preparation and so forth. So that is those are the kinds of costs that are certifiable. And the next slide then shows what the gross and net forestry revenues have been for the last six fiscal years. And I think the five-year average, if you look at it, is about 60% of the income is used for management costs. and did talk a little about how fiscal 07 was a little different because of increased firefighting costs and kind of a downturn in the timber industry. Then this slide shows trust management costs for forest repurposes versus trust revenue to give kind of some sense of what the activities generate. About a little over 2 million acres of trust land is managed by forestry. Of that, about 1.5 million acres is capable of producing timber of commercial quantities. And 29,000 acres are reserved from harvest. That's about 2%. And that will represent things like land that's put in old growth status. I think Mr. Epperle could speak in more detail on that. But Minnesota is certified by two different organizations for our timber harvest. And part of that certification, I'm told that having examples of certain kinds of timber preserved is part of that process. And so there are 29,000 acres of school trust land that have been designated as old growth forests. And just to give you some perspective, about 18,000 acres are harvested in any 1 year. And that's something less than 1%. And so, you know, looking at the cycle for tree growth, Mr. Krebs could speak more knowledgeably on that. But, you know, for certain kinds of trees, it's 40 years, I'm told 50. For others, it might be a 100-year cycle to generate income. So just that natural progression, it's about 1% a year or so that's harvested. And finally, the last slide is a slide of some school trust land that was in Itasca State Park. And some gorgeous trees. This could not generate income. And just to let you know that there was around 10,000 acres of school trust land in state parks. We have been working away at exchanging that land out so that the land can remain as a park, but then other substitute land could generate income for the school trust land. And this past fiscal year, we were successful in trading out the last 5,000 acres of land that couldn't generate revenue. And so there is currently something like 700 acres left in state parks or state recreation areas, but they're in the in parks that can generate revenue, like Hill Annex State Park. We, for example, have four taconite leases to Esther Steele in within the boundaries of that state park. And there also are some lands in the Cuyuna Recreation Area, but those lands, too, are capable of generating income, so we did not exchange them out because they can make money for the trust. And so with that, Mr. Chair, that's our presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bateson. Ms. Lewis, further questions?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Not a question as much as an observation and a comment, and thank you, Mr. Vadas, as usual. A well-put-together, comprehensive, and concise presentation. But I think Representative Solberg's questions, I think, cause us to remind ourselves that with the new sort of emphasis in state statute, Mr. Chair, I suspect that this committee will really be required to kind of perhaps dive a little bit deeper than we have in the past in terms of asking some kind of nitty-gritty management questions and management cost questions. I think that responsibility was always there, but I think the legislation really stresses that is a major expectation of this committee to get into the finer, perhaps a little bit more of the finer details of how these lands are managed and how costs are attributed. And I think I appreciate Representative Solberg's last question, but I think that we should perhaps get into the habit of actually having more of that presentation or that kind of information here at this table as opposed to merely just distributed individually to our individual offices. So I think there'll be a little bit of a shift in terms of, you know, culturally how we operate within this committee, which, Mr. Chair, in addition to all the other work I have to do, means that I'm going to have to work a little bit harder. So anyway, thank you, Mr. Vedas, for your presentation.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question, Mr. Vedas, and that is in Aiken County, there's exploration being done on some of the trace minerals as well, copper, nickel, platinum, palladiums. Are any of that done on school trust fund lands, and are those leases then generating any income?
Well, Mr.
It might
Chairman,
be a small amount, but
Representative Solberg, there's a company, Rio Tinto, has been exploring in Aiken County and Carlton County on it's a mafic intrusion similar to the Duluth complex for about 7 years. And they have thousands of acres of state-owned land under lease, including school trust fund land that they're exploring right now. And they have intersected a very encouraging intersection of copper and nickel mineralization in that area. And that particular intersection is on state land, but it's on Concon land. And that company continues to explore in that region. It's a body that's about 30 miles in length, so there's a tremendous amount of area that they're looking at. And they continue to work. As a matter of fact, in January, it's expected that they will have five or six drill rigs operating in that region, evaluating that mineral land that they have under lease.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks again. We'll go next to Bob Meyer from the department, Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The colors indicate your place of birth as well.
Okay. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and I was born here in St. Paul at St. Joseph's Hospital. So, but I do try to spend as much time as I can outstate, but it doesn't seem to work as well as I want it to these days. On behalf of Commissioner Holston, I do want to thank all of you for being willing to participate in this important group and help us make sure that the expenditures and management of trust lands that the department manages for the state is acceptable, and we are doing our best job as possible. I think the committee work will show that, and we look forward to working with this committee and presenting the work that you need to do and helping pull that together. I just want to go back to the changes that Mr. Nauman went through, and if you could pull that out, or just really quickly on page 4, I want to just remind the committee of one thing that is really the way the department directs our activities on permanent school fund, trust fund authority. 84.027, subdivision 18, the last part, number 4, there in the middle of page 4.
Excuse me, are all the members on the same page now? Page 4 of the handout and referring to the statute?
It directs the department to manage the school trust fund lands efficiently, maximize revenues, et cetera. But you see, we also need to do that to maximize a long-term economic return for the trust fund while maintaining sound natural resource conservation and management principles. This is really the yin and the yang kind of the department's management of these lands. It was a piece of discussion, or it was discussed while we were moving this legislation through the process last year, and it was one that the legislature wanted to make sure was not lost on our management of lands. There is a natural resource benefit to these lands as well that we must take into effect. So that kind of directs our management activities, but also trying to maximize the revenue wherever possible. I just wanted to make sure that people were understanding of that. And also, I want to take a brief minute or two to introduce our staff that will be supporting and doing the administrative work for this committee. First of all, Dan Rourke is a person within our Lands and Minerals Division. He's a real estate realty specialist. He will be working on the school trust program, so he will be interfacing with many of you as well. Also over on the side there, Marty mentioned Dave Epperly. Dave Epperly is our director of forestry. He'll be working with, if there is a subcommittee that will be proposed on forest management, working him and his staff working directly on those, talking about certification, management, things like that. Next to him is David Shad, who's our Director of Fish and Wildlife. He also does play a substantial role in the management of school trust lands as far as the natural resource benefits and providing the recreation benefits on those lands as well. And also I want to introduce Kathy Anderson, who will be providing administrative support to the committee as well. So the question was that did come up on how that was going to be done. Those are the people that will be working with this group to make sure that our duties are met and we're moving forward in a expeditious manner. Other than that, Mr. Chair, I know you have some subcommittees that I think you're going to walk through, and I just wanted to take a brief minute to introduce the staff, talk about where we're at. We do take the role of trust fund management very seriously. It is a sound principle that we do take place. We overview the management of those trust lands as a top priority fiduciary responsibility for the state and for the department. The certification cost that were brought up is one that the committee does need to get into a little bit more. There was a 1998 legislative auditor's report that, if you're not familiar with, we can send you out a link to that electronically that does kind of go into the certification, forest management certification processes in more detail. Their findings were that the way that we certify those costs are appropriate. And another one or two of those findings is how we ended up here today as well, by adding more kind of technical expertise to the Permanent School Trust Fund Advisory Committee as well. So we can make sure that you have that as a resource for you to review as well, which will provide the background for those forest management discussions, which I look forward to in the future.
Thank you. We did ask DNR to prepare some suggestions on subcommittees. I think it's clear that the legislative was intent, as earlier described in the handout by Mr. Nauman and alluded to in discussion, was for us to dig deeper into the fund, the practices, and to provide constructive recommendations in that annual report. Usually that annual report, which is good, will have a good recap of the transfers and financial information, but in terms of additional insights from the legislative branch and other expertise, we haven't taken full advantage of that, and that's why we're here. So now that we know there's a substantial fund, resources at stake, and with that background, it's our charge to develop these recommendations as to how we might advise the trustees of this fund, advise the legislature as well. And that's particularly where you, as the new members, can be of help. And as Representative Mariani referred to, there's a myriad of legislative activities that we're involved in. And, frankly, this would be one meeting a year where we would just receive the report. But we need your help, particularly new members. And we have put together proposed subcommittees at the DNR. I just offer it as a suggestion for what we might do. But Mr. Myers, if you wanted to just highlight these subcommittees, and some of you would be very natural chairs for any number of these, and we'll ask anyone to step forward if they'd like. And I think the big picture here is that I'm hoping that we might be able to form some of these subcommittees either today or in the near future. Administratively, we'll work that out. And then that we would have those subcommittees would be meeting over the next, during the next year, but would be meeting particularly over the next 5 months to develop some thoughts that we can discuss when we have our meeting in June up north. And so that's the thought. And so be thinking yourselves as to if there's a particular subcommittee or some other variation that you'd like to offer on the subject. Mr. Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The document I'll be working off, I think you all have in your packet, it says Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee meeting on the top, and then proposed subcommittees on the bottom. Does everybody have that? And before I go into this, let me also say that It's our goal to make these subcommittee meetings as easy as possible. However, we can do it through telecommuting, video conferencing, to minimize the impacts on people that on the travel and work impacts is what we're looking at doing. So we'll have to work with staff, make sure that we have the capabilities to do that through those statutes, which I think we have. I don't know if the open meeting law shouldn't hamper us too much on those activities. But by working through our regional offices, perhaps with video conferencing or teleconferencing, whatever we can do to make it the most efficient and effective use of your time is what we're interested in as well. So take that, keep that in mind as we're looking for membership on these. We did identify four subcommittees that are kind of hot topics that are going on out there, and I'll just run through those and talk a little bit about what we see as some of the potential issues that need to be dealt with. The first one surrounding climate and energy, we have carbon credits and wind. So wind energy is a couple of the hot topics there, and this subcommittee would review the DNR's plan and advise the DNR regarding the production of wind energy on trust lands. Also review the DNR's plans and advise the DNR in the development and evaluation of marketing of carbon credits that may be associated with the management of lands. A couple of the ideas or the issues that are out there is as we lease a spot of school trust land for a wind tower, a turbine, should that be done on a square foot basis or should it be done on a kilowatt hour of revenue, things of that nature that these people are making money off of the resources that are there. The as we look at water as a public resource, I believe the wind is as well. So that's a difficult issue that we are grappling with right now, and we do need some advice and guidance from this group and also the legislature on how to do that. The carbon credits issue as well, carbon sequestration credits, it is a hot topic not only in our state but nationally. How do we take it into consideration the carbon sequestration of forestry, of reforestation activities, of, I know peatlands are, there's some question about management activities and things like that, but the peatlands do provide substantial carbon sequestration benefits and would release substantial carbon amounts upon mining of some of those areas. And a lot of those are protected anyway, but the energy and carbon, climate change issues and advantages for trust fund management and revenue enhancement are realistic, and we do need to talk about that and get some guidance. Sale and exchange of property, I think Mr. Vadas outlined the sales that we have done in the past. We are trying to look at more expeditiously certain pieces of property that may be able to be sold with benefit of the trust but not have a huge negative impact environmentally. Perhaps one of the things this group can talk about are putting easements, conservation easements on these lands, selling them out, making them part of larger exchanges, things like that. And the processes that are there in legislation are quite cumbersome for us to do. In the past years, we have been successful in procuring legislation that allows us to expedite some of our exchanges on certain types of land. It does not apply to school trust land, though. That may be something that this group may want to talk about. How can the state do that more expeditiously, more efficiently? Boundary Waters Canoe Area, this kind of comes and goes about every 5-10 years, depending on how long you've been around. There's about 86,000 acres of trust land within the BWCA that is non-revenue generating for the trust. The other states have been successful in working out land exchanges with the federal government to do that. I think it's a time that it needs to be evaluated once again, and it will need some legislative leadership to get that done, communications with the federal government. But this group, I think, would be able to focus on the activities that other states and local units of government have been able to do in regarding federal exchanges, and hopefully come up with some recommendations and provide some leadership on that. Then lastly, but not leastly, any other ideas you may have as well are always welcome. The Forest Management Subcommittee, reviewing our plans and procedures for revenue generation for forest products and making investments to increase growth, quality, productivity on trust lands, and providing other beneficial environment and recreational values, and then provide advice to the department and the legislature on those activities. This committee, I would assume, would also be reviewing and looking at our forest certification procedures and costs, making sure that those are appropriate, as we talk about Representative Solberg's questions, fire suppression and then the certification of those dollars, and then those dollars that are certified go back to reimburse the general fund. Those are important concepts, especially now as we're looking forward into dealing with budget issues. How do we do the work on the land that needs to provide long-term economic growth while also dealing with general fund impacts that we have to face to getting work done? So that would be an important subcommittee as well. These are just four of kind of what we look at. I don't want to say the low-hanging fruit, but the highest needs for some direction and support, stakeholder involvement and support to kind of come to the resolution and make sure that we're moving forward in the best manner for the trust.
Thank you. Reaction to the formation of subcommittees, and open it up from there. Yes, question, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer, the sale and exchange property subcommittee and the BWCA subcommittee, you think they could serve together or not? You think there's going to be enough need for a separate BWCA committee?
I'll refer to Marty on that. He would probably have a better idea.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, that's a fair observation, and we actually talked about that internally with DNR. And that certainly could be run together, but I'll tell you, there's such a history and so complex on the BWCA issue. It just seemed like highlighting that one and concentrating on that one would be a job in and of itself. And the other kinds of land management, sale and exchange and so forth, doesn't carry the same sort of difficulty or controversy that particular one does. And it's more what's in the best interest of the trust long-term to generate income rather than all of the rest of the issues that come along with trying to exchange land out of a national wilderness area. So it just seemed to us that maybe that was special enough to hold that out separately. And that may not be right, but that was our thinking and why we proposed two of them.
Okay, thank you.
Further, Mr. Herman.
Bob or Marty, what is your present level of thinking about how the school trust lands and the exchange process might interrelate with the land funding that we're going to get from the 3/8 cent? I mean, it obviously offers for the first time an opportunity to do much larger scale exchanges than would have been possible in the normal course of events.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Herman, I think that's an excellent point. That's a very new concept. And I'll tell you, we have been working a way to fulfill the requirements of, I'll give you the statute number, it's 92.121. which directs the Commission of Natural Resources to sort of deal with those lands, trust lands, through either legislation or administrative decisions that can't generate revenue. And so examples of that would be the ones in state parks that we recently completed, but others would be like the SNAs or certain kinds of wildlife management areas where the land really can't generate revenue. So the options are to exchange those out to compensate the trust fund through a lease, for example, or another potential one is to extinguish the trust by purchasing it. And so there's, you know, different options on how you could accomplish what that statute directs DNR to do. And if there is a potential source of income that could be used to help accomplish that, seems to me to be something worth considering. But don't know where the department or the LASARD committee is, if they're up to speed on what this issue is or not. So it just, top of my head, it occurs to me that we have that directive to deal with that issue, and, that may or may not be a source of funds to help accomplish that.
Further questions, comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, think I would just reinforce Mr. Johnson's comment about numbers 2 and 3 here. I've always thought that I lost a good share of my hair listening to Representative Rukavina pound on the Boundary Waters issue. And I would
not
see,
a good sign for me.
Yeah, that's right. I would think that one is going to consume the majority of the energy around the issue of exchange and sale. And that just looking at the magnitude of the exchanges and sales that have been done historically, that can't consume a lot of time either for the department or for this group, I would not think. So I would probably come down on the side of combining those two into one subcommittee activity. And I'd be interested in hearing about the states that had success on exchanging trust interests out. That has never met with any enthusiasm from the U.S. Forest Service here, unless something has changed in their attitude since I had anything to do with this. But it seems to me the sale there was the simple way out of the Boundary Waters issue. The numbers I remember on that, it was somewhere around $30 million worth of land at somebody. And have we got a new number on that? Much higher?
Yeah.
Well, that would make sense. But as a part of the federal budget, if you spread that over two or three appropriations, that's the way to get out of the issue of the trust fund lands tied up. So.
Combine them.
Okay, Mr. Myers?
Mr. Chair, members, I think combining those two committees would be okay. The one piece of it dealing with how do we exchange it, maybe coming up with some legislative recommendations, and then dealing with the larger issue of the BWCA, maybe two things that they could tackle simultaneously, I suppose.
Okay. Further comments, members? Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, kind of at your suggestion as well, I think, and others, and we've had a lot of discussion about minerals, and maybe we should consider some kind of a subcommittee to deal with minerals, particularly with the potential growth in that as well. And the reaction from the DNR on that?
Reaction?
Mr. Chair, minerals is one of my favorite topics.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, we will probably be spending a considerable time up north talking about what's happening in the minerals area, and it's changing all the time as well, and it's a very interesting concept.
We'll ask for a development of a proposed subcommittee on that and suggest that as well. Points well taken. And recognizing a limited amount of members, but perhaps we can we'll figure out a way to deploy all of our talents here. Yes, Mr. Krebs.
Mr. Chairman, I guess just a comment from a land manager standpoint on the two subcommittees. With the BWCA lands and the sale and exchange property, I do think that there's a need to streamline, improve that exchange process, so that when you're working with other public entities, that we can get into the consolidation of these lands. With a lot of the trust fund lands scattered throughout tax forfeited lands and other lands. It would behoove us to get that process, put a focus on getting that process streamlined so that we can get a lot of this stuff accomplished. It benefits the counties, it benefits other landowners, as well as the state in having more consolidated blocks of land to deal with. So,
thank you. Additional thoughts, comments on the other proposed subcommittees, and in the absence of comment to the contrary, that would indicate perhaps support. And at least tentatively, I'm looking at four subcommittees with the addition of minerals, with 2 and 3 on sale and exchange and Boundary Waters being combined. Is there consensus on that point?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think it's a good framework, and we were chatting a little bit about when we can have people meet. And, of course, For us as legislators, you know, session is a difficult time, but on the other hand, we are here from all parts of the state. I can envision subcommittees, meeting actually during session and then convening us all back together as a large group immediately after session, and perhaps having, early fall and another late winter meeting of the full committee. But I think it's important to get the subcommittees going and moving early. And who knows, there may be bits of information that can come out of those subcommittees that continue to inform the respective House and Senate committees during that period of time.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to make any points on what we've discussed thus far before we go to the next step on future actions of this group? Okay. What I would suggest then is that members think about those areas that they might have a strong interest in, and it could be each area. And if you will be contacted, maybe it's through Kathy or someone in DNR, you may be recruited or conscripted, we will ask for your active involvement in putting a work plan together. And you have the resources available from DNR. Legislators will get involved as well. But we're looking at particularly at your assistance and guidance of this. I think that's what the legislature wanted. And we'll work with you. We'll make our facilities available or whatever you need. Bob Myers mentioned if we have to teleconference, if there's other experts that you need, but we'll make that happen. So what I'd like is for DNR staff to further perfect the language for the subcommittees that we'll have, and there'll be subcommittees, and that during the next 3 weeks that we recruit a chair or co-chair, whatever the case may be, for these subcommittees, and that a work plan be developed that will respond to that charge. And it would be the intent that there be meetings of these subcommittees during the next several months with a progress report to our full advisory committee in June. And we'll meet in June and talk about what date might meet, and preferably it could be a meeting up north, which I'm sure we'll do. And that's how I'd like to proceed. So, further feedback on that.
Well, I wonder, Mr. Myers, if would it be appropriate to ask, this is being totally oblivious of what you have in mind in terms of administrative support, but I know you mentioned that Ms. Anderson provides administrative help. Would it be appropriate to have Ms. Anderson be in contact with all members of the committee with the layout of the of the subcommittees and then requesting what the preference might be of individuals, and then perhaps, maintaining some kind of connection with Senator Wigger in terms of reporting back, who's decided to do what and who hasn't responded, so that perhaps Senator Wigger can exercise his dictatorial powers to recruit folks. But would that be a logical way for us to move forward?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, yes, that will be, and we will pull together a listserv type email list so that everybody's on there and is aware. And then either Senator Wigger, or if you do get to the next thing on your agenda, electing a chair, we'll be working with the newly elected chair of the council as well, or the commission, to make sure everybody's informed, and we can certainly get that underway and move forward expeditiously.
Thank you.
And Senator Anderson, we know how active you've been on these issues, and I'd like to just do a brief recap to make sure you're comfortable. We have a proposed subcommittee mm-hmm. listing, and we reached consensus that items 2 and 3 could be merged together as a subcommittee, And then we suggested there be an additional subcommittee addressing the growth in minerals, as this is an active issue, obviously. And we then asked members to think about which subcommittee or subcommittees they might want to serve on. And hopefully, particularly the private sector here might chair one of those groups, and that we would make ourselves available to the extent that we can, and the climate and energy, other subcommittees that maybe we could take one, each of us. But we're going to ask that everyone at the table, and especially those that aren't here today for good reason, that couldn't, but that they be engaged in the process. And these subcommittees then would be meeting, you know, hopefully formed within 3 weeks or so, but meeting beginning of the year, and with recommendations to us when we meet in June. And that would be a proposed tour that we would have up north. And so that's the game plan at this point. And do you find that acceptable?
Yes, absolutely. Sorry, I couldn't be here for the whole. I was meeting with Senator Cohen, who's figuring out what bad news we're going to be facing tomorrow.
Yes, but
the budget forecast.
We will all get through that. So good. So on that note, that'll be the process, and we'll keep everyone aware. And we'll kind of, you know, the go-to, I guess, will be through Kathy, and we'll have a common email system so that people are aware of how it's tracking. We'll just show tracking the progress, and particularly I want to make sure that members of some of the committees involved are aware as well, and various stakeholder groups, and we'll make that commitment to them. And this will also be reflected in the annual report that's due January 15, 2009 to the legislature, and we'll show what we've talked about today. So that's where we'll proceed on that. And for the chair, we don't have a quorum, and so we'll need to defer on that at this point. And if it's okay, Representative Mariani and I will rotate, and he'll have the next meeting, and then with the presumptive quorum at that time, we'll proceed with that item of business. For the meeting schedule, I indicated what we'll do for the subcommittees, and that our full group would meet again in June for the tour. And actually, it was the tour that we had a couple of years ago, I guess now, that led to, you know, legislative changes. And we want to go back again to discuss more. And perhaps, Mr. Bates, if you wanted to, you know, give us a little overview as to what that might be, what the time commitment, if it's a day or two. And also, I wanted for Senator Anderson to think whether LCMR, if there might be any logic, if they must go up north as well, you know, if there might be any advantage to combining resources. I mean, they're separate agendas, but be thinking about that as a possibility. And then if we could hopefully tentatively put something on our calendar for June, if that's our consensus. Mr. Bates.
Mr. Chair, we did conduct a tour, I think it's 2 years ago now, and really tried to have an overview of the kinds of issues that and opportunities that impact school trust land. So, for example, we went to a mining operation, Taconite Mine, and took a look at that, but also looked at the issue of this copper-nickel development and the potential challenges that that has caused. We've looked at opportunities for real estate development, and along with that, commercial real estate leasing. And those are longer-term endeavors, and kind of what goes along with trying to consider doing that. And also that part of the statute that directs us to do things with sound natural resource management, we talked about the competing interests for school trust fund land. There's the income generation, but people like to use them for other things, you know, hunting and recreating and that sort of thing, and the opportunities that come up for us in trying to manage that, of creating revenue and recognizing that people want to use the land in other ways. And so I think there's ample issues to cover, and probably a two-day tour would be something to consider with an overnight somewhere. And it would most definitely be in northern Minnesota somewhere, because that's where the majority of the trust fund land is. And, you know, just to mention, we had a very lively discussion over old growth, standing in the middle of an old growth stand up north of Ely. And I think it was helpful for people to sort of conceptualize what the issues are and challenges.
Representative Rukabina was one of our mentors on that.
He was on that day, yeah.
And it was a year ago, actually, so. Okay,
so
let's look at some times in terms of times on the calendar that might work. Probably first week of June is your traditional graduation week, and beyond that, are there any preferences? And we'll survey everyone, but is there any thoughts as to the month of June?
Mr. Chair, I think we were proposing two dates, just to throw those out. And those dates were June 17th and 18th, or June 24th and 25th, as just potential dates.
The day of the week is what?
What were the dates again?
Wednesday, Thursday.
Oh, Wednesday. Thank you. Or 24 or 25. Reaction from the committee on either of those two times? Was there any major event through other organizations that conflicts with? Yes. We're not going to want to be here if we are.
I predict no.
Senator Anderson?
Oh, I just said I predict we'll be in session. And I'm an optimist, usually.
Okay, well, we will remain optimistic.
Yeah, we'll just remain optimistic.
Okay, but tentatively we'll say either one of those, and then we'll formally survey Kathy as to what works best. And Senator Anderson, on the LCMR, is that something that's viable? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's certainly possible. The LCCMR, let's see, I did a mining tour, but that was with my committee, not with the LCCMR. So.
Okay.
I don't believe we've been up to northeastern Minnesota, at least for a couple of years. I'm trying to think the last time we do a couple of state tours every year, and I think it would be something, depending on what the agenda is, that LCCMR members might be interested in. So mm-hmm. We can certainly put that as a possibility.
Well, if there was
John
a bus going
on
up,
the
we
LCCMR.
Could.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
We were talking last year about doing a mining tour on LCCMR,
yeah.
So
yeah.
I think it might be possible to make that a combined visit. And I think there's quite a bit of interest on LCCMR in terms of the forest legacy easements, and so there's a little bit of an overlap there.
Okay, well, we'll ask DNR to process to try to look at that, and if there's any other group that would be appropriate, and obviously those entities could still have their own separate meetings, but for the resource of going up and for tours and also recognizing that there's people involved in all of these activities where it might be beneficial.
Well, Mr. Chair, we also have the New Heritage Council, which is focused on land around the state and habitat, and I'm also a member of that, and so I can check in with that group and see if they, we just started. We just had our very first meeting, and, this is using the new amendment money, and so we'll see, but I know there's a lot of interest in doing some statewide either tours or hearings with that group, so there may be some interest there as well.
We'll hope to have this pinned down within the next 2 weeks, if not before, and in terms of what the date would be, as to whether other groups will be involved. That'll be, hopefully within a month, but we don't want to wait until spring to decide when it's going to be. So, for those arrangements and other things that would need to be done, we'll look at that.
And then conferring with Representative Mariani, we thought the after the June meeting, we would meet again in fall to further process what their recommendations are from the subcommittees, further reaction that we have from that visit, and hopefully lay the foundation for the report then that we'll give to the legislature in 2010. Further comments, questions regarding the proposed course of action? Okay, well, again, particularly new members, I want to welcome you on behalf of the legislature. We deeply appreciate your willingness to serve. Look forward to working with you over the next year and beyond. And if there's anything you'd like to discuss with us, please let us know. Call us, and you have the staff fully available to assist as we go about this very important mission. Representative Mariani?
Yes, sir. I just want to commend you for preparing us well for this this meeting. You put a lot of thought into these subcommittee works or proposals, and have been communicating with DNR, and I appreciate the time and effort and the commitment that you you make to this work. But I look forward to working with everyone over the course of the coming year.
Great. And members, please leave the, not that you would be taking this, but please leave the name cards in your folders there. And if there's materials that you want to take with you, go ahead. Otherwise, we'll keep that in the folder. And I assume we will have electronic file documents available, too, that if people want that, particularly for those that couldn't attend. There being no further business, this committee is adjourned.
Just brought on time.
Yeah.
Big meeting.